Playback on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Dublin Airport's Airport Club. Make travel effortless with lounge access, stress-free parking, fast-track security and exclusive duty-free savings.
Good morning. On Thursday, a little after 5 o'clock Irish time, this.
Just for the moment, because I'm looking at the screen here and it seems we have white smoke.
Habemus Papam, Cormac, and rather the surprise here in the Vatican. I don't know if you can hear in the background, the bells of St. Peter are now ringing through Vatican City and ringing through Rome. White smoke in the last 60 seconds has come from the stovepipe atop the Sistine Chapel. And this really, as you say, is quite the surprise. This perhaps
the 267th Pope was selected by 133 cardinals on the fourth count. And a little over an hour later, Pope Leo XIV stepped onto the balcony in St. Peter's Square and addressed the crowds.
And he emerges onto the balcony of St. Peter's Basilica, waving to the crowds and smiling. Cardinal Robert Prevost will be known as Pope Leo XIV. And the crowds underneath, throngs of people now with St. Peter's Square full. And we're seeing images of young people with their smartphones taking pictures of
a lot of emotion. You know, a lot of people crying.
And it's quite dramatic, isn't it? And the pageantry of it as well, with the Swiss Guard and so on. It is a dramatic moment.
Fratelli, sorelle, carissimi. Questo è il primo saluto del Cristo risorto, il buon pastore che ha dato la vita per il gregge di Dio. Anch'io vorrei che questo saluto di pace entrasse nel vostro cuore, raggiungesse le vostre famiglie, a tutte le persone, ovunque siano, a tutti i popoli, a tutta la terra. La pace sia con voi.
Cardinal Robert Prevost, now Pope Leo XIV, will lead members of the Catholic Church's global community of 1.4 billion. Initial reaction? Surprise. Back to Barry Lenehan in Vatican City.
Monsignor Enda Murphy beside me, you said one word when Robert Prevost came out, Pope Leo XIV he is now. Wow.
Wow is right. You're right, his name was mentioned and he had been gaining currency over towards the latter end of this whole process. But it is history making. We were talking about, you know, the God of surprises doesn't fail to disappoint again.
And he is the very first American Pope. And from his native Chicago, a similar reaction from Heidi Schlumpf of the National Catholic Reporter.
I have to say I was a little bit gobsmacked myself, although for National Catholic Reporter's list of front runners, we did have him on the list and say that of all the Americans, he probably had the best chance. In part, that's because he hasn't spent his entire life in the United States. He is truly a global citizen in many ways, so I think that probably helped him in the election.
Yeah, indeed. One of our previous guests was saying they believe he was probably the least American of all the American candidates to be Pope. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I think that's the way he's going to be described, as the least American-American.
But the 69-year-old has spent most of his career as a missionary in Peru and only became a cardinal in 2023. And while many were surprised, nay stunned, at this selection, not so much theologian Gina Menzies. Robert Prevost had been on her list for a whole host of reasons. She joined Mary on Morning Ireland.
He's very much a Peruvian. I don't like all the emphasis. I know he was born in the States, but he's lived most of his life in Peru. And when I looked at, you know, his diplomatic, his work experience, how he worked with the oppressed in South America, and added to which, I think it's interesting, I think I was saying earlier, he has a degree in mathematics, which nobody has actually landed on so far, which I think is very interesting because most of the candidates have a humanities background. And I think it's very important that a pope would also have a background in, if you like, the sciences.
Why is that important, do you think?
Because I think when the church looks at the whole area of the world, well, the reality of the world today, science and medicine is throwing up new things day on day. And, you know, in the past, for example, at the moment, the church at the institutional level is supposed to assist reproduction. Now, I think if you sort of dig down into all those kind of issues and understand the science, I think you have to come to a different position. And that's why I think that would be important. I think he will listen to all the voices. I think he's very much in the mould of Francis. And I think it's interesting, Francis brought him to Rome and gave him the job of appointing bishops. And I think, you know, the future of the universal church is going to very much depend on how bishops, you know, take up that mantle. But I what I like is that, you know, the Peruvian connection that when I was studying theology, the theology that appealed to me a great deal was liberation theology, which began in South America in the sort of late 1960s, 1970s. And the father of liberation theology is Gustavo Gutiérrez, who happens to be a Peruvian.
And notably, in his very first address, Pope Leo XIV spoke in Latin, Spanish and Italian, but not English, which, as the Auxiliary Bishop of Dublin, Donal Roach, told Ornia, was telling.
That was very noticeable that he didn't speak English, even though he's from Chicago and obviously an English speaker. I think that was a deliberate thing to say that the church is not about the English-speaking world. It's very much centred now, I think, in South America and in developing countries. So by speaking Spanish and Italian, I think that was a nod to that.
But what of the faithful here at home? Well, Northwest correspondent Shane O'Kareen got this reaction from mass goers at Knock Shrine in Mayo.
It's great. He's a young man. He seems to be following in the footsteps of Pope Francis. And please God, you know, he's great for the young and for the underprivileged and the poor.
I guess we're happy, number one, that he's from the United States. And number two, he's from Villanova University, which is right in our area. And, you know, we're hoping that he'll be a great leader of our church.
The vibe I got from listening to him speak as he came out was really wonderful.
I'm just excited to see what he's going to do. I love that he prayed the Hail Mary, and I'm just happy.
I know the Catholic faith is the Catholic faith, but, you know, I like to open things up because Pope Francis was starting to do it, and he showed that as well by the amount of cardinals he elected. Please God, be a good future, good future.
My hopes are that he will be, I think, a great pope at the right time, multilingual, carrying on the tradition of Francis, so hopeful.
I would have great hopes, and he's American, which I find is interesting. He'd be up to our friend over across the pond, but anyway, we won't go into that now this evening. And he's the right age. He's... You know, see, 2 years younger than me, a lot more wiser, I'd say. But anyway, but I wish him well.
Oh, indeed. But do we have any idea of what kind of person the new Pope is? Certainly his election was something of a dream come true. The News at One brought us this clip of the Pope's brother John talking to journalists in Chicago.
The first Pope from Chicago and my brother. You know how some kids like to play war and be soldiers, and some kids, girls want to play dolls and be housewives. He wanted to play priest. And so he took our mom's ironing board and put a tablecloth over it, and we had to go to Mass. And we went to Mass, and he knew everything. He knew his prayers in Latin, he knew his prayers in English. And he did that all the time, and he took it totally serious. It was not a joke, it was not a game. Isn't that interesting? Now that's how you know.
Oh, maybe so. But on Drive Time, Archbishop Dermot Martin had a slightly different perspective.
I was surprised when his name appeared, but I think probably if anybody's surprised, it's he himself, because I don't think in any way he was expecting this. He's always led a rather quiet, reserved life. He's a very calm person. I think this has been said before. A very humble person. You know, people will say various things about the new Pope, but I can say one thing. I can tell you where he bought his groceries, because he went and bought them himself, even as a cardinal. He lived in a very, very simple life, and I think that's going to be very much the mark of this man. Nothing very dramatic about him personally, but a systematic, careful, thoughtful, kind man.
And for Father Iggy O'Donovan, it wasn't Pope Leo, it wasn't even Robert Prevost, it was Bob.
He's a fellow Augustinian. and we spent some time in Rome together as in our younger days. But obviously, our paths diverted a little then, and he has gone a little higher than me.
How will your
But no, but I did know him. But he was known as Bob Prevost. That's how I knew him. We were first name terms for a long time. And I remember he was ordained in 1982. I'm finding it hard to call him Leo. Yeah. Oh, I never knew him except by his first name.
Yes, I understand, yeah.
But I, as I say to the proud, it's the first time an Augustinian has ever, a member of our order, has ever been Pope. I would say a middle-of-the-road guy, nice guy, intelligent guy. But he has probably got now what I would call the loneliest job in the world.
Yeah.
And as more details emerged as to who this new Pope was and in what direction he might take the Catholic Church, would a visit to Ireland be on the cards, or rather, another visit? Here's the Examiner's deputy political editor, Paul Hosford, on the late debate.
I think the important thing, the Irish Examiner is already reporting that the Pope has visited Cork.
He visited
Cork in 2007. He was in Cork. He was in Ireland a number of times between 2001 and 2013.
Right. Did he like it better than Dublin, though? That's the question.
Well, he's only human. He may be infallible, but he is only human. So, of course he did.
But there are a host of very real challenges facing the Catholic Church, and much was made of the choice of name, Leo XIV. Might that give the faithful any clue as to this Pope's political leanings? On you put this to Father Donald Roach.
Where would you place him, if you like, on that spectrum from left to right?
Liberal or conservative, I think, is the wrong question. I mean, the Pope is a Catholic. So he's not going to change anything too radically, I think. Who knows? But I do think that particularly in the area of immigration, what he said to J.D. Vance about migrants, I don't know, is there any significance even in the fact that an American was chosen? Was it because of the situation in America?
Because the tradition was no Pope would come from a superpower.
Absolutely. Nobody expected that. But I think we'll see. I think people will see him more as a South American president because he worked in Peru for so long and was a missionary. But this great voice for immigrants, for the poor, and the name yeah. Leo, the connection with Leo XIII and Rerum Novarum, the rights of workers, opposing socialism and communism, standing up for trade unions, standing up for children, the rights of children, all of that that Pope Leo XIII stood for. I think by choosing the name Leo again, that's a continuation with that Pope as well as with Pope Francis and synodality.
And yesterday, in the official end to the conclave, Pope Leo XIV celebrated his first Mass.
I begin with a word in English, and the rest is in Italian. But I want to repeat the words from the responsorial psalm. I will sing a new song to the Lord because he has done marvels. And indeed, not just with me, but with all of us, my brother cardinals, as we celebrate this morning, I invite you to recognize the marvels that the Lord has done, the blessings that the Lord continues to pour out upon all of us. Through the ministry of Peter, you have called me to carry that cross and to be blessed with that mission. And I know I can rely on each and every one of you to walk with me as we continue as a church, as a community of friends of Jesus, as believers, to announce the good news, to announce the gospel.
Pope Leo XIV in the Vatican's Sistine Chapel yesterday. Back in a bit. Welcome back.
Lorcan!
That's the way he pronounced my name.
Lorcan Finnegan, the director behind The Surfer. The he in question, Nicolas Cage. No muck here. Now Nicolas plays the surfer in question, who returns to his childhood home in Australia. Don't ask. But all he wants to do is catch some waves with his son. But oh man, he comes up against the locals who want him gone. And Nicolas Cage, he don't want to be gone. Lorcan spoke to Oliver.
I'd say it's like on the surface level, there's like it's comedy, it's action, it's torment, it's psychological dread, it's all of the kind of fun stuff, and an amazing performance by Nick Cage. But then on another level, and there's all this, you know, there's these themes around masculinity and crisis,
oh, yeah, big time, yeah,
and all of that, and basically an incredible look at men's faces, I think, in the film. I actually asked Nick to grow out his nasal hair and his ear hair and his eyebrow hair and everything so that he kind of uses face as a landscape.
His stubble is almost like his lips have disappeared. You know, this kind of strong beard growth.
Yeah. But so on one level, it's, you know, pure entertainment. On another level, it's, you know, an exploration into all this, and it's kind of existential and cerebral, and you can kind of pick it apart afterwards, some of the kind of more Jungian themes throughout the film.
Well, hello. But when you have Nick Cage on set, he brings the crazy, well, he is playing a man, paired right back to the primal.
He's walking around barefoot. He's asking people, have they seen his broker anywhere? And I think in the script it was written that, you know, he's asking, has anyone seen my broker? And then rambling incoherently.
That's great. I love that too. That was very good.
So, but so the rambling incoherently, you know, then Nick was let run. We were shooting on a really wide angle, 8mm lens. So all the crew had to kind of hide in cars around the place.
Yeah.
And we, because you can see everything, walked around, and he started going on about, I want to make dinner for my wife on the balcony. I'm going to make her clams casino and puttanesca pasta. And like that scene ran on for longer than is in the film. He started actually singing Jump Around by House of Pain, which is great. I think he has this sort of thing inside him that he needs to let loose. So that, and then there's a scene in the film where he shoves a rat in somebody's face and says, eat the rat.
Yeah.
And that was something that came to him.
Did the actor know that was going to happen?
Well, we did do a quick rehearsal. It was basically in the script, he picked up the rat and he was like a burrito. He's about to bite into it. And then the guy from Cave's house sees him, and then he was supposed to just drop it and we could go on with the rest of the film. But he put it in his pocket, and Nick just had this idea of wanting to keep the rat in his pocket. He was like, I need it. I don't know why, but I need it. I feel like I need to keep it. And it was like a prop rat, so the art department, we only had one.
It looked
like,
great. Yeah, it looked
Well,
very, very convincing.
Nick just really wanted to keep it in his pocket. The next day, he told me this idea that had formulated that was based on the movie Sabrina with Audrey Hepburn. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene where a character takes an olive and shoves it in another guy's mouth and says, eat it. And that's somehow linked to our film. And
he's got a lot of old films rattling around his head.
Exactly.
Inspiring at various moments.
Yeah. Horsing through the scenery. The Surfer out in cinemas now. And by the way, Arena viewers gave it 4 stars. So there. It started at midnight and went right through the night to 7 in the morning. We speak, of course, of the annual Dawn Chorus.
It gets to a stage, like sometimes when you hear an orchestra, you can't pick out the individuals, but it's the sum of all the individual parts you're listening to that gives it that power. And I think what we've just been listening to now here at Birdwatch Ireland, Kuskany Marsh Nature Reserve and Cove is just that. It's the sum total, because you've got to really concentrate to try and pick out the blackbird from the song thrush and the wren from the robin. And then you've got, of course, the wood pigeon keeping it nice and low. That's easy enough to... It's just amazing.
It is, and they're all in their own sort of unique frequency bands, so they kind of blend together and they're filling all of that sonic space now. Yeah. You can hear the wren cuts through that very fast, very loud song. There's this bedrock of blackbirds now. There's many of them singing, and it almost becomes like, no offense to them, background noise. And one on by itself, it's the most beautiful song. When you hear so many of them together, actually you hardly notice them anymore. And that wren cutting through there. In that little phrase, it's singing over 200 separate notes in the space of just over a second. It's incredible.
What a sound, and to think it is every morning. Niall Hatch and Jim Wilson accompanying that orchestra. And Mooney Goes Wild celebrated 30 years on the air with a documentary from Colm Flynn charting the rise and rise of the Nature Programme and its team. Here's Eric Dempsey, the Birdman.
What makes birds special are feathers. Nothing else in the entire planet has feathers except birds. Feathers allow birds to do so many things. They've allowed birds to fly. They've allowed birds like penguins, emperor penguins, to survive down in the Antarctic. They allow birds to dive under the water. They allow birds to fly at great heights, like barheaded geese, which fly over Everest. They allow birds to migrate. They are incredible evolutionary things, feathers. Feathers are what makes a bird
And you can't do the birds without the bzzz with the late Philip McCabe, the bee man.
I remember once, and I remember the date exactly because it was my birthday. It was the 25th of June. It was back in 2005, and Philip was going for a world record.
He's stripping off, he's stripping down to his underpants. Well, Philip is going to try and set a world record.
They're going to pour 500,000 bees onto me in aid of Bohor.
And what he had decided to do was to place a queen bee on his body, stripped off, he's only in his underpants, this is down in the field in Tipperary, and what they do is they wanted all the female bees to come and to land on his body.
He's hoping to get 100 pounds weight of bees attached onto his chin, and he's had to wear the back brace because he just worries because of the weight that will be, he'll be leaning forward because of this. So the world record is 87.5 pounds, he's confident that he's going to hit it.
Terry Flanagan on the late Philip McCabe. And of course, Mooney, still going wild every Monday night. Now, an interview that might just stop you in your tracks. On Sunday with Miriam, Defence Forces Chaplain Father Paul Murphy. In August 2024, he was the victim of a random knife attack by a teenage boy. He survived, and after the court case ended and the boy was sentenced, Father Murphy hugged his attacker and told him he forgave him. He talked to Miriam about the night of the attack.
The reason we're here is because somebody tried to kill me. But apart from the fact that somebody came to kill another person, everything was blessed on that night. So, for example, I was late coming home from the pool. So I was maybe 15 minutes later getting home, got down to the gate of the barracks. There's a procedure entering any military installation where you would dim your headlights so that they can identify who you are, put on the light inside in the car. And I had done that, and somebody approached my window, my driver's side window, and I put down the window. And, you know, when you press the button, it's automatic nowadays and it goes all the way down. And for some reason, my window didn't open fully on that night. It opened 2/3 of the way. And if it had opened the full way, I would be dead. I mean, I had a certain protection in my car. I was able to take my foot off the brake and the car started up again. It was an automatic car. And it started moving towards the gate. And then it became an option for me to drive through the gate to try to get away from this person who was stabbing me. So I was able to, you know, crash through the gates of the barracks. But he kept coming with me all the way into the barracks and kept trying to stab me with the knife. And, you know, I believe there were maybe 20 deliberate attempts on my life in the bit that's on video. While I didn't remember his face, I do remember the determination on his face and the real intent to, you know, to put an end to my life.
And he had a remarkable perspective on what had happened.
It was a totally random attack, wasn't it, Father? So do you think of yourself as very unlucky that you were the person that was attacked?
No, you know, that was part of the commentary afterwards. I mean, this news went around the world to Canada, America, South America, Australia, India, you know, messages came to me from all these places. And you know, the general consensus was that I just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Now, I would dispute that, and I would say that that wasn't the case at all. In my view, I was the right person in the right place at the right time. And the fact is that, you know, that boy had come to kill a soldier. That's a matter of record now. He'd come to kill a soldier, and I thank God every day that it was me that he got to rather than one of the others. You know, we've a lot of young soldiers there. They come and go walking, you know, walking out the gate, walking in the gate and so on. I'm of a certain age now and I have worked with the Order of Malta, as I said, for over 40 years. I've been a priest for almost 30 years. I've been in the army for 11 years. And I just felt that I was in a position where I could contextualise what happened in a way that would be much more difficult for somebody who was a young soldier, male or female, starting out in life. You know, we had a young female soldier on the gate that night, half my size, and she, you know, did a super job. But, you know, it would have been a much different story if somebody had walked out and had been confronted by that knife.
And Father Murphy told Miriam of his conversation with the young man who tried to kill him.
I just, you know, whispered into his ear a few things and embraced him in the hope that, you know, that the offer of forgiveness would change something. Mm. You know, you can fight hate with hate and then we become entrenched in our hatred and we continue to hate one another. And I think there's enough of that going on in the world. St. John says that God is love. And if that's the case, love is stronger than hate. So I just believe that if I can fight hatred with love, well, then there's an opportunity for something different to happen. There's a different outcome. And, you know, my only hope and prayer is that that kid who was radicalised and so on, you know, that's a matter of, you know, accounted for in the court and so on. That he will have the opportunity and take the opportunity and use the opportunity and benefit from the opportunity of being de-radicalised and be able to return to society. You know, as I said to him, he's 17 now. He could have another 80 years on this earth. And that if he can do this for himself, it means that he can make a good, positive contribution to society for the rest of his life, rather than just being full of hatred. So it will benefit him, it will benefit the rest of the world too.
That is quite remarkable. And he talked about the media attention around this case and the surprise expressed at his willingness to forgive his attacker.
People have often said to me before, how do you forgive? How do you do this? And I just think that if you can work on the small things and try and get those right, well, then the big things, when they come along, take care of themselves. So, I, you know, like, we preach forgiveness. I'm in the business of forgiveness. I hear confessions. You know, I'm privileged to impart the forgiveness of Christ to other people. So to me, it's a really basic thing in life to forgive. And listen, that doesn't take away from the hurt that people feel. You know, there are many other cases going on, I'm sure, in the court today where people just find it really, really difficult to forgive stuff. And in particular, when it's on behalf of others. So, you know, my son is killed. I can't forgive his killer, my wife, my whatever. It's very, very difficult because you want to get justice for that person who's not around to do it for themselves. It's much easier, I think, for me, because it's me, I can do it more easily. But I do understand it's a difficult thing. But what I am surprised at, there's been huge media attention, as I say, from around the world, and people want to make documentaries and people want all sorts of things. I'm just surprised that a bit of mercy and compassion is so extraordinary, or seems to be so, that it makes headlines. And maybe if we were a bit more forgiving in the world and a bit less harsh on others, we might just have a better world.
An incredible outlook, Father Paul Murphy on Sunday with Miriam. Back in a bit. Welcome back. In massive radio news on Thursday, just before 3, this.
After 37 wonderful years here in RTE and 27 years presenting Liveline, I just wanted to share a few words with you as I prepare to move on. First of all, it has been, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart, an incredible honour and a privilege to be part of a programme that relied almost entirely on trust, the trust of our listeners. Listeners felt they could pick up the phone, ring Liveline, share their lives, their problems, their stories, sad, bad, sometimes mad and funny, their struggles and their victories. I never took that for granted, not for a single minute. Over these years, I've been blessed to work alongside hundreds of producers, researchers, broadcasting assistants, and the wider public servants who make RTE. And when I say everyone, I mean everyone. Those who lift the paintbrush, wield the Black & Decker, a Hoover, operate a sound desk.
Radio Palpitations, Joe Duffy. End oh, an era, without a doubt. Here's Lisa Pereira on what it says in the papers on Morning Ireland.
I've had the time of my liveline, is the headline on the front of the Herald, as it reports that the presenter is to leave RTE after 37 years. 27 of them were on the phone-in radio show, which the Irish Daily Mirror refers to as the window into our soul. The phrase, the court of public opinion, also comes up. Some of the coverage mirrors that of the Pope. Mick Heaney, writing in the Irish Times, says Duffy's announcement yesterday caught listeners by surprise. Melanie Duff in The Independent calls it a bombshell. It may have come as a shock to listeners, she writes, but quietly in the background, RT was putting plans in place for his departure. The show must go on is the headline there. Readers will also spot that both Duffy and Pope Leo are aged 69.
Ooh, the Lord working in mysterious ways. And it has been quite the ride. We've laughed, we've cried. And when the live line was open, you spoke, we listened. Sheila Nocton compiled this for Morning Ireland.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. And tell us about the symptoms you had.
I had cyclical depression, I had tinnitus with ringing in my ears, I had night sweats, I had flushes, I had migraine with aura, I had tingling, I had dizzy spells, I had all over body pain, I had vertigo. Towards the end of it, before I got better, I did become suicidal.
Okay. I've been given 2 to 4 years from diagnosis to live. The chemo is to prolong life, not to save it. I have 3 years tops to go. My husband has suffered right alongside me in his own way, knowing that the woman he loves will soon be dead. But today, when I heard that a very nice man who was in the same, if not worse, condition than me, when he went to his GP, is going to live because he had private health insurance, and I'm going to die because I didn't. I had to bite my tongue. I'm happy he's going to live. He deserves to live. But so do I.
Temperatures here, 30 plus. As a veterinary nurse, what do you think of the idea of hanging a goat for 3 days in that weather?
I think it's inexcusable, to be honest, that they're thinking that it can go ahead.
Well, I imagine it was like something you would expect to see in a porno movie. Certainly not for family viewing.
What would you see in a porno movie, Mary?
Well, I don't know, because I never watched one. I've just imagined.
Doc Savage is with us.
I was just saying there's three fellas in the pub down the country. The weather is good. You know, got locked into the pub one night. It was about 4 o'clock in the morning. The fella looks up and says, look there, the moon is still out. The other fella says, no, that's the sun. So the other fella says, settle the argument, is that the moon or the sun? He said, oh no, I'm knocking around here.
We've been waiting such a long time. Nearly 50 years, now Johnny's here with Logan's cheer.
Christmas Eve, Grafton Street. Aww. But he's on air till June, so lots of time to talk to Joe. And another massive story this week, one that led a good few programmes, the issue of skorts. I'm sorry, pardon?
Skorts, Russell Carroll Kelly's way of saying skirts.
Thank you, Joe. Yes, the coy love child of the skirt and the short. Unless you're living under a rock.
Skorts are shorts covered in a fabric that makes them look like a skirt.
And thank you, Marty. And at the weekend, in the Dublin Kilkenny Leinster Senior Camogie semi-final, in a coordinated protest, the women togged out in shorts. They were sent off the pitch to change back into the skorts. Otherwise, no game. On Monday, we got the lowdown. Here is Senator Evan Na Cuillin.
Players, Evan, feel that their protest is their only option. They want the option of being able to play in shorts. Tell me, why are skorts the choice for the Camogie Association, do you think?
Well, I think, and I think you know too, that it's going back a very long time. And I think the skirts that were worn when Camogie was first played, you'll know, were down to the ankles, and it was all about modesty and femininity. So the skort has developed over time. Yes, it is more, it's easier to play in. It's probably more comfortable than wearing layers and layers of material down to your ankles. But it's still not the preferred option for players. And I think as a player myself, I mean, I stopped playing 14 years ago, but I remember nobody wore a skirt at training because they're not comfortable. They're not the first choice for anybody. And if you look at, like, I'm coaching now at under 10, the girls don't have to wear skirts yet, but they will have to at age 12 or 13. And what, do you want to turn them off and maybe create a barrier at that age? I mean, we're trying to keep girls in sport and in camogie. So I do think that there's a danger now that it'll be a barrier going forward. But, like, it's important to point out that this is not a new problem. It's not a new debate. It's not a new outrage. I welcome it. But, like, this was first challenged in 1959. It's a very, very, very long standing issue.
Also in studio, Angelina Nugent, reporter with RTÉ Sport.
The GPA survey, which I can think they sent to me on Thursday morning, out of 650 players that were tested, 83% of the girls wanted a choice between either wearing shorts or a choice. They wanted that choice. So what are your thoughts on this?
The choice, to me, is a no-brainer. Follow the correct process and give players the choice. But at this point in 2025, that we're directing players to wear something that they say they feel uncomfortable in. You know, if a player is telling you, the person who's impacted is telling you that this is not comfortable to play in, they don't want to do it anymore, then you have to listen to them. But it's extremely important that that correct process is followed, because I would hate to see us having this discussion in 5 years' time again.
On Drive Time, the issue of skirts was their 5 o'clock lead, and for veteran Waterford player Niamh Rockett, the skirt was as tricky to wear as it was to pronounce.
The issue of skirts, I know this has blown up last weekend. I know it was an issue as well last year after the Congress vote. But has it been an issue for you throughout your career?
Yeah, look, to be honest with you, I go training in shorts. I go running. If I'm doing next outside running session, I do it in shorts. If I was going training and one of the girls is wearing a skirt, you'd be kind of looking at her as if she had nearly 10 heads at the moment, you know. It's way more comfortable training in shorts. I don't know anyone on Air Waterford Camogie team that enjoys wearing the skirt. And to be honest with you, when you're playing a match, where I'm after playing for obviously the last 17 years, and I've gone from junior to intermediate to senior, and when you're playing a match, the last thing you want to be worrying about is how you look like in a skirt, or if the photographer is going to take a picture of you in a compromised position wearing the skirt, you know. And
it's interesting.
It's not,
so do you feel,
like, you know?
Is it, you feel more exposed in a skirt than you would in shorts?
Definitely more exposed in a skirt as opposed to shorts. Like, we were playing even Tipperary 2 weeks ago in the Munster semi-final, and I fell down. I got tripped up in the match, and the first thing I could think of is, oh my God, my skirt's up on my back, I should pull it down, rather than, and I was half winded on the ground. So right. It was the first thing I had thought about, as opposed to if you fall in shorts, no one, you're not thinking of what's the shorts like behind me, do you know? And yeah. I suppose there's an argument then, oh, would you not get a longer skirt, or would you not get a size up? But the longer it goes up then, the longer it goes across your knees, and it's just very restricting then when you're trying to run and lift your knees, as opposed to a pair of shorts, which are more dynamic, they're more comfortable. Do you know, it's just, I suppose it's a no-brainer really for practicality.
Drive Time on Wednesday. Now, there were a lot of twists and turns on this one. We'll keep it brief. The start of the week saw a motion to go before Congress in 2026. But if the rules were relaxed, there wouldn't be a change until 2027. No one was happy with that. Abandoned. But then on Thursday...
This is a major development. Special Congress will be called by the Camogie Association in 2 weeks' time on May 22nd, with only one item on the clock. But essentially, it's all about the permission to individuals to wear skirts or shorts.
Phew, you're thinking, well, that's that. What a palaver. Oh, but no, gentle listener, because that still leaves the Munster final between Cork and Waterford. And on Wednesday's News at 1... this stand being taken by Cork Camogie player and six-time All-Ireland winner, Aisling Thompson.
Have you on the teams been discussing what you'll wear then?
I think the across the board, we're going to wear shorts on the day. I think that's what we do have to finalise, I suppose, and have a chat on that during the week leading up to the Munster final. But I think what we're going to do is wear shorts, and if we're asked to return to the dressing room, we won't. And if that means abandoning the game and handing over the Munster title to Waterford, that's what we'll do. We're just hoping that Waterford will follow suit. It's not about us versus the association. It's kind of standing up for what's right, I guess. And, you know, creating something that will affect, I guess, in a good way, like younger athletes down the line when they do get to represent not only their counties but their clubs too, that like they will have a choice, and you know, maybe this might be the push that everybody needs to get over the line in this decision.
From Wednesday's News at One. And yesterday, even Minister for Sport Patrick O'Donovan had gotten involved. He didn't want games abandoned and hoped that cool heads would prevail, but wouldn't intervene. So, skirts, shorts, squirts, all eyes on the pitch, but maybe not, unfortunately, on the game itself. Let's go back to where we began. Marty on Monday with Senator Evan Ní Chuilín.
And I hate to bring it back to a gender issue, but if we were having this debate about men not wanting to wear a skirt or not wanting to wear a certain type of material, it would just get sorted. We wouldn't have to, you know, be kind of screaming from the rooftops about it. And you know, it bothered me over the weekend that I didn't see match reports about the Leinster Championship semi-final. I just saw people giving out
headlines
about women. It's the headlines you know, negative stories again about women in sport. So let's sort out the skirt issue and then let's write about the matches.
Leaving that there. But the weather, still lovely.
But Ray, I have to say,
Bernard O'Shea, by the way.
Now there's rumours. I love when it gets nice and warm in this country and there's a good bit of weather, because the minute it gets nice, what happens? Somebody comes out with the rumour. It's going Friday. Where is it going? Like, is it getting a cheap flight out of the country? Like, where? No, it's going. I heard. Where did you magically hear this? I heard. Well, now it's
on the
it's
weather forecast. The morning, yeah. Ireland, Bert.
Listen. Flip a coin. Listen. Like, in fairness, I don't give out about the weather forecasters, but the weather in this country, yeah, you can never predict it.
Unpredictable.
And then they got into salads, and something quite unspeakable.
I have this lovely memory of my childhood salad.
Yeah.
And it was butter lettuce, which is that limp lettuce.
Yes.
Right? Then you would have had some cooked ham.
Yes.
Yeah. Then you would have had some scallions. Now, they call them spring onions now.
I know. Right? Yeah.
Right. Hard boiled egg.
Yep.
Are you still with me?
I'm with you. Yeah, I'm with you on the hard boiled egg. Yeah. I call them scallions too.
Yeah.
I think, and as far as, I don't want to interrupt your salad roll here, but I think that we all say spring onions because in Chinese restaurants, but I think Chinese people, when they're making them, they call them scallions too.
I think so. No,
but
this isn't a salad roll. This is a salad on a plate.
I know, but I'm thinking linguistical roll. Sorry,
Yeah. And then you have a bit of beetroot, which often would have bled onto the white of the hard-boiled egg.
And every white piece of cloth in a four-mile radius. Yeah.
Then there would have been coleslaw. And this is the pièce de résistance.
Yeah, go on.
Which is controversial. Cold baked beans.
Put down the microphone, take off the headphones and leave.
Wrong, wrong, wrong. And that is it from this week's playback. And we will finish with something from Tuesday's arena, a barnstormer of a gig, when Keela were joined by the Paul Frost Brass Band to launch their album, Raise the Road. From Studio One, this is Disco Biggs. Oh, and thanks for listening. Talk to you next week.